Well, good morning. I'm Craig Carter, and we're glad that you've chosen to worship with us today, either here in the worship center or online. And we're continuing our study of the letter of James. And this New Testament book has a lot of practical advice in it. It shows us how to live as Christians. We've observed along the way this fall that in many ways, James is like a commentary on Jesus' teaching. It addresses many of the same subjects that Jesus talked about and explains how those are to be lived out in practical sort of ways. You probably have heard that Jesus talked about money more than any other subject, and that's absolutely true. And given that fact, it's not surprising that James also addresses the topic of money. Jesus said that wealth, material wealth, can be dangerous to our spiritual well-being. So much so, he said, no one can serve both God and money. You see, the problem with material wealth is that if you don't have it, you're tempted to want it. And if you do have it, you're tempted to want more of it or to spend what you do have in unwise or ungodly ways. And James has something to say to people in both of those categories, those without wealth and those with wealth. He begins his discussion here in chapter 1 by talking to those without wealth. He says, believers who are poor have something to boast about, for God has honored them. And maybe some of you right now are saying, man, I got a lot to brag about then, if that's the case. But you don't feel very honored by it. Now, why would he make that statement? Well, because people who are poor, who don't have material wealth, realize that that condition is temporary. In contrast, the riches of God's kingdom, both present and future, are eternal. I like the way this verse is translated in the New Century Version. Believers who are poor should be glad that God has made them spiritually rich. So believers who don't have much material wealth can be happy about that because they realize that even in that condition, it's temporal. And ultimately, they have God, and God is enough. Then he turns his attention to people who are living with wealth. And he says to those people, those who are rich should boast that God has humbled them. They will fade away like a little flower in the field. The sun, hot sun rises. The grass withers. The little flower droops and fails. And its beauty fades away. In the same way, the rich will fade away with all of their achievements. It's interesting. He says even those who are rich should boast, should brag. Why? Because God has humbled them. Well, what is that all about? Well, again, remember, who is James writing to? He's writing to believers. Okay, he's not just talking to rich people in general. He's talking to believers. And specifically, he's talking to believers who have been scattered due to the persecution. And so it was right that he first addresses those that are without, because most of those people were pretty poor, right? Probably even in destitute. But maybe some of those people that have been scattered now have accumulated some measure of wealth. And he says to you, well, rejoice in that, but don't rejoice in the wealth, but in the fact that God has humbled you. In other words, that you as a believer realize that what you have isn't going to last forever. That really, spiritually speaking, you are poor. Okay? Now, we understand the fleeting nature of riches, don't we? It's here today. As James says, it's oftentimes gone tomorrow. You know, much of our wealth as a nation is tied up in the stock market. But we've seen how volatile it can be, right? Where vast amounts of wealth just disappears in a moment's time. Many of us in this room remember Black Monday of 1987, right? Or the housing crisis of 2008, or even this spring that was caused by the COVID-19 shutdown. Suddenly, wealth just here one moment, gone the next. Can anybody say Hurricane Michael? Okay? That which some of us had worked an entire lifetime to accumulate was literally blown away in a moment's time. How about the flowers that adorned your yard this summer? James says, well, they were beautiful then, but then they drooped, they wilted, they withered, and they died. And wealth is that way. It's fleeting. It might be here today, and it's gone tomorrow. And so he says to believers who have some measure of wealth, well, understand that principle. Understand that what you have isn't going to last forever. But that makes you realize that while you might be rich in stuff, you're really poor in spirit, and that will cause you to turn to God. Remember what Jesus said about this subject? Blessed are the poor in spirit who realize that they are sorely lacking. They have a need for God, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. New Living Translation puts it this way: God blesses those who realize their need for Him. Are you beginning to get the message that James is portraying here on how to live? It's really the same for all of us, whether we have wealth or whether we don't have wealth. We need to realize that whatever we have is really nothing in the span of eternity. But what God provides us, His riches, those are what is really valuable. And so, he says, and this again, reading from the New Century Version, believers who are poor should be glad that God has made them spiritually rich. And those who are rich should be glad that God has shown them that they are spiritually poor. The message for us is this: if you're poor, well, don't worry about it. Trust God. If you're rich, don't rely on it. Trust God. You get the message? That's how you live with wealth. That's how you live without wealth. It's just trust God. Now, I mentioned that James was writing to believers who had been scattered due to the persecution and oppression. That's kind of that, y'all got, we okay? Want me to go to another mic? You do want me to go to a mic, okay.
All right. Now we okay here? All right. Where were we at? All right, let's go back to the beginning. No, I'm not going to. Some of you said, I just remembered I got to leave real quick. No. Okay, so he's writing to believers, and most of these folks are poor, maybe even destitute, but apparently some of them have accumulated a little degree of wealth. Now, I've said along in this study that in the first chapter, James addresses a wide variety of subjects, and then he spends the next four chapters kind of circling back, talking about them in more detail, and he does that with wealth. He addresses it in those verses in chapter 1. Then he comes back to the subject in chapter 5. But it's interesting, in chapter 5, he says nothing about those who don't have wealth, that are poor. He talks only to the rich, and yet most of his original readers would not have been very wealthy. So why did he do that? Well, I think it's because James knew some other folks were going to read his letter one day. Maybe never envisioned that folks 2,000 years ago in a place called the United States of America was going to read it, but God, who inspired it, understood that. And so there's a message in chapter 5 for those who are rich. Now, I know the immediate objection, okay? Turn that off because I'm not wealthy. Well, before you reach that conclusion, let me just share with you some statistics about your wealth and my wealth. I would suggest to you that everyone in this room, regardless of our economic situation, is wealthy relative to the rest of the world. Here's some statistics. The median household income in America is about $45,000, and that might be conservative. I found some statistics that say now it's actually closer to $55,000. That means half of the American households earn more than that, half earn less. But let's just go with the conservative figure, $45,000. We know that 10% of Americans are beneath what the government defines as the poverty level. Okay? That is $13,000 for an individual, or it's about $26,200 for a family of four. Okay, $26,000, anything below that, you're living in poverty. According to the government definition, for a family of four, that's about $18 per person per day. Just keep that figure, $18, in mind. Okay? Our median household income is $45,000. Worldwide, the median household income is a little less than $10,000. We're partners with churches in Uganda. The median household income, meaning half the people there, make less than $1,775 a year, okay? And there's eight countries that are even lower than Uganda, okay? What do you think? Maybe we are kind of wealthy, right? Well, let's take it another step further. Look at this in terms of the income of those people. Okay, about 7.8 billion people on this planet. 70% of the people on planet Earth live on less than $10 a day. Remember what I said? What's the poverty line in America for a family? $18 a day. 70%, over 5 billion people, live on half of that. 40%, 3 billion people, live on less than $5 a day. And 10%, that's the folks in Uganda, live on less than $2 a day, which the World Bank defines as extreme poverty. I don't know about you, but I'd put anybody on that list as extreme poverty by our standards. Here's the point. You and I, because we are followers of Jesus, we are rich in God's eyes. But man, we are also rich in the world's eyes. And so I think James chapter 5 has something to say to each one of us. And if you haven't read these this week during the daily readings, just be prepared. Okay? It's some pretty harsh warnings. And it all harkens back to chapter 1 that says, hey, hold really loosely to material, worldly wealth, and hang on tightly to God. Here's what he says. Pay attention to this if you are rich. Who's that? It's you, it's me, okay? Cry and moan about the misery that's coming to you. Your riches have decayed and your clothes have been eaten by moths. Your gold and silver are corroded. Their corrosion will be used as evidence against you. Like fire, it will destroy your body. You have stored up riches in these last days. Sounds a lot like Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, who says, don't store up treasures here on earth. Why? Because moths eat them and rust destroys. I would hazard a guess that every one of us in this room has a closet full of clothing that is excess. We're hoping that one day it's going to come back into style. It ain't. We're hoping and wishing that someday we'll fit in it once again. We won't, okay? And we have closets full. And what do we say about that clothing? We didn't say, I've put them in what? Mothballs so that they won't ruin. How many pieces of outdoor furniture do you think have belonged to us and rusted away? I know since I moved to Lynn Haven, I've already disposed of and bought a new gas grill because the bottom of it just fell out of it due to rust and corrosion. But notice what James says. It's not just those things that will rust and ruin, but they will actually corrode and ruin you. I learned an important lesson about car batteries when I was in high school. We had a car break down. I went and picked it up at the shop. My dad told me, and I don't even remember why it was, but they gave me the old battery to take home. Now, some of you don't recall these days, but car batteries didn't used to be sealed. They had individual cells with little screw on tops, and you put distilled water in there to keep the cells wet. And I knew you put water in there. I didn't know what happened to it. And so this battery that was bad, the caps were loose, some of them missing, and I just sloshed a lot of the water out of the battery. I went to a football game that night, and I remember looking down, and all of a sudden my pants didn't have holes in it. Large parts of my jeans were just gone. Okay, my shoes started disappearing before my very eyes. And I walked out of the football stadium with flip-flops instead of tennis shoes. And I literally, the shoelaces were stuck in eyelets, but they weren't connected to anything. Why? Because there's something called battery acid that corrodes, that eats away. And James says, that's what wealth is like. It will eat you up. And then he says at the end of this passage, he says, you've stored up riches in these last days. The New Living Translation puts it this way, this treasure you have accumulated will stand as evidence against you on the day of judgment. The treasure that you've accumulated. What's wrong with accumulating treasure? I mean, isn't it a good thing to save for a rainy day? Well, of course it is. But there's also a very thin line between saving and hoarding. Okay? You hear that? Thin line between saving and hoarding. You know, we save for the future because, as James says in chapter 4, we don't know what tomorrow might bring, right? But also, we don't know when life is going to end here on earth. And what James is cautioning against is that ending our lives and standing before the throne of God on that day of judgment, whether it's because Jesus comes again or because death visits, in either case, he says, just make sure that when you stand before God, you don't have too much in your bank account. Because you might have been storing up stuff for yourself while neglecting people around you who were in need. Remember what's said back in chapters 2 and 3? If somebody needs clothing, somebody needs food, don't just say, well, good luck. No, you do something about it. And I would hazard a guess that for most of us, we will die with more in our accounts, our bank account, than really needs to be there. I read about a principle a number of years ago that's always stuck with me. It was an idea of bouncing your last check. Now, none of us knows. It would be nice, wouldn't it, if we knew when our life was going to end? And the idea is if you knew that you would spend everything you've accumulated, you'd give it away, you'd do good with it, and the last check would bounce, okay? That you would have spent everything during your days here on earth. Now, we don't have those guarantees, do we? But as I said, there's a thin line between saving and hoarding, and I find most of us err on the side of hoarding. And so I would suggest to you that some of us in this room, if not most of us in this room, maybe need to get busy spending some of our kids' inheritance, okay? Now, I don't mean that by going on a cruise or buying well, that might be part of it. That's okay. But what I'm talking about is use your money, what you've accumulated, the wealth that God has given you, and use it for good. Don't depend on somebody else to make those decisions. And also spend some of their inheritance on them while you can enjoy seeing them benefit from it. I think I've told this story before, but my wife Lee's mom died several years ago. And when she died, there was very little to dispose of in her apartment because she just had a practice of giving stuff away. If you went in her house and said, man, I really like whatever, that lamp, you were going to go home with that lamp. She would do that. She had a very extensive jewelry collection. It had all been given to her by her sons, had got her some really nice jewelry. And she just started every Christmas, every birthday, giving Lee a piece of that jewelry. At first, Lee felt guilty because she knew her brothers had bought it all, given it to their mom. But she said, I don't want you to have it someday after I'm gone. I want to see you wear it. And so she's picked up on that practice. And every birthday, our daughter Abby gets a piece of that jewelry so that we can enjoy the use of it, so that it doesn't stand against us on the day of judgment. Our kids both graduated from college this past year, embarked on careers. They got nice professions, but they're not real high paying. It's a school teacher and a social worker in a school. So we decided rather than wait for them to get their inheritance from us someday, we're going to spend it on them now. And we helped them get some cars that would be very dependable as they start a new career. We helped them with a down payment on a house so that they could launch out. Also so we could get them out of our house. That was part of the motivation, but you know, why save it till later? Let's put it to use right now. And I know some of the objections. There was one that I had. My mom died a year and a half ago at the age of 91, and I'd always tell her, you know, spend it on your grandkids or do something, get something nice or give it to this cause that's near and dear to you. And she'd say, well, you know, I don't want to spend it. I don't know how long I'm going to live, and I don't want to be a burden on anyone. You ever say that? Ever heard that? I'll just give you permission. Be a burden on your kids, okay? They've been a burden on us for years, so we might as well be a burden on them. Most of us aren't going to outlive that money. We'll take the risk. But don't let it stand against you on the day of judgment. Do good with it right now, I think, is what James is saying. And then the final thing he says to those who have wealth, I think definitely applies to us living in 20th century America. He says, the wages you refuse to pay the people who harvested your fields shout to God against you. The Lord of armies has heard the cries of those who gather the crops. You have lived in luxury and pleasure here on earth. You have fattened yourselves for the day of slaughter. Boy, those are some harsh words, right? You know, we decry in America the loss of jobs that have gone overseas. But you know what? Most of us don't mind buying the cheap goods that are made in those overseas locations, do we? You know why they're so much cheaper? Because those laborers don't get nearly what our workers get. And even some of our workers don't get a fair living wage. Okay? And that's contributed to great income inequity in our country. And I've seen it firsthand over the course of my lifetime. I grew up in a small Midwestern town that was highly industrialized. It was just filled with factories. And in my hometown, you either owned one of those factories or you worked in one of those factories. My dad worked in one of those factories. But you know what? I knew, I had friends that their parents owned those factories. So one of those factories became a Fortune 500 company. Most of them are now large, multinational corporations. But you know what? I knew the kids whose parents owned them, and they lived in a little bit nicer house, drove a little bit nicer car. They got to go on vacations. We didn't. But there wasn't a large difference between the folks who worked in the factories and those who owned them. Is that true today? Not at all. And what James says is God says, I see that, and if you don't make it right, one day I'm going to make it right. And I don't know about you, but this final image, you know, is one that haunts me, where he says, you live in luxury and pleasure while other people are suffering. And he says, you fattened yourselves for the day of slaughter. It just looks like an image of a bunch of grain-fed cattle who are fat, dumb, and happy. They're just content. But they don't know they're being raised for one purpose, for the butcher shop. And that's what he says. If you have wealth, if you're using it for yourself, saving it all for yourself, not helping other people, that's what you're like. So how do we live with wealth? What do we do about it? Well, we recognize that riches and treasure, money and wealth, they are not evil in and of themselves. Don't get me wrong, there's nothing evil about money. As a matter of fact, it's neutral, and it can be used for some really good kingdom purposes. But it is dangerous. And accumulation of wealth is dangerous because it can easily become our source of security, and that we rely on it rather than trusting in God. So if you don't have money, trust God. If you do have it, trust God, not that wealth. Now, that observation has caused Christians to have various approaches to how to handle their wealth. Some folks, most notably somebody like St. Francis of Assisi says, well, just renounce all worldly wealth. Take a vow of poverty. Just do without. That's a valid approach. Other folks, most notably the founder of our denomination, John Wesley, says, well, it's okay to accumulate some measure of wealth, but just make sure it doesn't grab hold of you, that it doesn't eat away at you, that you get a handle on it. And so he, in particular, proposed a threefold formula for how to live with wealth. I've taught it before. You remember it? It's gain all you can, save all you can, and give all you can. It's okay to earn all you can, to accumulate worldly wealth. Just make sure you do it in an honest way, in a diligent fashion. Don't cheat people out of it. Don't do it to harm other people. But it's okay to earn all you can and then save all you can by spending wisely, by saving consistently, but also remembering, what did I say earlier? A thin line between saving and hoarding. and you gain all you can, you save all you can, not for yourself, but why? So you can give all you can. And when we give all we can, well, that's what Jesus is talking about, that we then store up treasures, not here on earth, but where? In heaven. That we send it on ahead. That we store up treasures in heaven. And the starting point for that giving is 10%, a tithe, right, of our earthly wealth. But it goes well beyond that. The real Christian understands that everything he or she has belongs to God and says, God, what do you want me to do with it? That's how you live with wealth. Now, I would just ask you right now, just look around, literally, physically. Just look at the people down your row. Look in front of you. Look behind you. Elbow the person next to you. Wake them up. Okay? Just look around. The folks that you're looking at, most, if not all of them, know how to live with wealth long before I preached this sermon. This is a congregation that gives and gives and gives, that understands that whatever measure of wealth God has blessed us with, it's not for ourselves, it's for God's purposes and to meet the needs of others. And because of your generosity, this church is able to take out of every dollar that is given in our ministry, giving, out of every dollar, 10 cents of it or more goes to help people in need and to broadcast the message of salvation. And this year, because of the COVID shutdown, because we didn't have some of our in-person ministries, we didn't use all of our ministry budget money. And so we have reapportioned that. And we've channeled that to serve God's purposes in other people's lives. And I just want to share some of those with you, ways that this church is giving all it can and beyond in two particular categories, and that's food assistance and in helping churches build. First of all, food assistance. You know, right across the street from us is the New Horizons Learning Center, okay? If you've ever been over there, almost every kid over there comes from a needy background. I have lunch over there once a week, and at the end of lunch, they come out of the kitchen, and the workers say, anybody want another lunch? And the kids just storm trying to get another lunch. They're hungry. And so we provide snacks in a mentoring room. They're there all day long. This church provides, keeps that stacked every single day so that kids have something to eat. There's 65 kids at Southport Elementary School that went home this weekend with a bag of food. And this is some of our kids, Awana's bagging it up on a Wednesday night. There's kids right today that are eating something at home up in Southport that wouldn't have had anything to eat this weekend if we hadn't given them those bags of food to take home. 65 kids every week. We invest over $13,000 a year in providing that food. Next Saturday, you saw, we're going to have a food truck. We're going to give away 25,000 pounds of food. That will serve more than 300 families right here in Panama City and Lynn Haven. And because of the pandemic, we find the needs of hungry people are greater than ever, but even more so in other countries. And we've been able, because we're not able to take mission trips this year or bring some of our mission partners here, we've been able to refocus that money. So we've sent $7,000 to Honduras to buy food that a local church has given out in their community, and that's pictures of that. We have ministry partners in Durango. I just talked to them this week. The city of Durango, Mexico, total shutdown. They can't leave their homes except for emergency purposes because of an outbreak of COVID. Most of the workers there are day workers. They can't go to their day jobs. And so we've sent more than $4,000, and that's them delivering boxes out of the Nueva Vida Church in Durango. And then in Uganda, same thing, incredible needs. That picture is from just last week. We've sent $4,000 to them, and that is their substance. That's the food that they were able to buy with that money and give to their church members and the people in the community. And then in Ecuador, this is a picture of a ministry called Loaves and Fishes that was founded by some Methodist missionaries there. Several times a week, they provide hot meals to these school children. Okay, so those are ways we're providing food assistance. And then we're also helping in building churches. You know that in Uganda, we've already built 8 churches that all look similar to this one. Okay, but they also double as a school. And this was a picture we got just a while back. that the kids, where the church worships on Sunday, the kids go to school there during the week, and this is them with their report cards that they had gotten, okay? And you know that Pastor Isaac is our contact there. He's helped us build those 8 churches. But his own church, which is a large congregation in the city of Jinja, services about 200 people on a typical Sunday. Their kind of wooden structure was falling down, so it was destroyed. And we're erecting a permanent structure, a brick, that he estimates is going to last them 100 years. And we've paid entirely for that church. We've invested more than $25,000 in it. And we just sent them a check a couple weeks ago that's going to put the roof on that. And then next will come some doors and windows, and they'll be able to occupy that building. And all that happens because of the fact that we have folks in this church that gain all they can, they save all they can, but they give all they can. Because I say, our church has sponsored all these projects, but we don't have any resources of our own, okay? It's what you as members and participants share with us. And again, I just see on an almost daily basis incredible generosity. People giving faithfully, consistently, the tithe and well beyond in little ways and in small ways. And I just want to share with you just a few ways that I hope will inspire and motivate you, some of those things that have happened. Remember this spring, a lot of us got stimulus checks from the government for the COVID, the program for that, the CARES Act. And I think I published a video and an email that said, hey, if you're not out of work and don't need it, give it to somebody that does. And we had a number of families that either gave that to our Good Samaritan Fund that we use to assist the needy in our community with medicine and housing and food, clothing, or they just found some folks in their neighborhood that were out of work and said, hey, I want to pay it forward. We've had 2 families in our church. I shared about one of them a few weeks ago that through some business ventures attained a profit. They gave the church $10,000 earmarked for that Good Sam Fund to give to folks that are in need, have immediate physical needs in their households. Okay, one of those families does not even live here anymore. They moved to another part of the country, but wanted to be a part of what we're doing here in and through the Lynn Haven Church. We just had a family move from here to move back to be closer to their family. They sold their home, took some of the proceeds, and before they left, they wrote their last check to the church. It didn't bounce. That's the good news. It was for $10,000 to build the next church in Uganda. And we've had a number of folks just in the last probably 6 weeks that have settled estates from family members. It was a sister, a mom, a husband. They got insurance proceeds, part of the estate, and they gave $44,000 in total to the church, to many of these mission projects you just saw, and a whole host of other ones, saying this wasn't ours, it's what somebody else worked to earn and to save, and now we want to give it for the cause of Christ. I don't know if you're aware of this, especially some of you that are a little bit younger. I'm a baby boomer, and I'm one of the last of the baby boomers, but I don't know if you're aware of it. I don't know if it's anything to brag about, but the baby boomer generation in America has accumulated more wealth than any generation in the history of the world. You aware of that? But we're not going to be around forever, okay? And so estimates are that in the next 30 years, $68 trillion worth of wealth accumulated by the baby boomers is going to be passed on to the next generation. And some of you millennials and others are all going, yay, all right. Okay, I just want to say to you, the examples I gave you are some folks that were all in my generation or older. And I just want to say to you that when that gets passed, I don't know if you know how much $1 trillion is. I'm talking about 68. It's a lot. I don't know how much it is either, but it's a bunch. But don't let it eat away at you. Don't let it ruin you. Use it for God's purposes. Here's the final thing I want to say. I want to share a new word with you. And it's not made up. I do make up some words as a preacher, but this one I didn't make up. It's potlatch. Anyone ever heard that word? It comes from Native American culture. And it's the idea that real wealth, the value of wealth, is found not in the accumulation of it, but in giving it away and investing it in others. And so in a potlatch community, the richest person isn't the person with the most, it's the person who has given the most away. And I don't know about you, but I'd sure like to one day be known as a potlatch person. That my kids and others would say, man, he just gave it. He gave it away. And how about us as a church? Wouldn't that be neat if folks in this community would say, man, that Lynn Haven United Methodist, that's a potlatch congregation. And I'm telling you, we already are, long before I preach this message. And I just want to give you one last bit of evidence to prove that. Many of you know the name of Tyler Vitito. Tyler grew up in our church, part of the youth group, felt his call to ministry here, ultimately became our assistant youth minister, and then moved away. And he and his wife, Kat, are now on staff at the Orange Beach United Methodist Church in Orange Beach, Alabama. And here's a picture of their family. I just got a letter from Tyler, and I want to read a portion of that letter to you. He begins by saying in that letter that he visited, came back here right after Hurricane Michael, went over to the sanctuary and Transmitter Road, and you know, his heart was broken by what he saw. He said that sanctuary was special to him. He and Kat were married in that sanctuary. He preached his first sermon there. He had played, both of them had played in the praise band on that stage. But he says as he gathered with a group from our church, he realized what was most important to him wasn't that building, but the relationships that had developed. Now, just fast forward. He said, we watched with anticipation and joy to see how you have faithfully navigated the challenges brought by that storm. Little did we know then that we would soon experience a storm of our own. Hurricane Sally brought nearly 3 feet of water into our home in Orange Beach, Alabama. Dumpster look familiar out front? We lost all of our furniture and belongings, every piece of clothing that they lost. My family was safe because we had evacuated to my parents' home in Lynn Haven, but we felt defeated and saddened when we started to receive pictures of our home. Almost immediately, though, we started to receive texts and calls from our family at Lynn Haven United Methodist. We didn't have time to feel discouraged because so many stepped in to help relieve our burdens, helped us remain optimistic and hopeful. And in his book, Five Practices of Faithful Congregations, Bishop Robert Snasey explains that extravagant generosity is strong evidence of a vital and healthy church. Be encouraged to know that you have shown extravagant generosity to my family and my community during this challenging time. I want to thank you for reminding me of the powerful things God can do through a church when his people remain faithful and sensitive to the needs of others. You have cared for us. You were present in our home. You assisted us financially. And I just want to say there that you aren't aware of it. It was a decision made by the leadership of our church. But again, they lost almost everything. They had flood insurance that paid for that damage in their possessions. But they also had wind damage that caused them to lose the roof on the house. And because of a high deductible, and that was the only damage caused by wind, they were out a roof. And our church stepped in and essentially put a new roof on that house for them. You have organized different ways to help us with the process of rebuilding our lives. You have loved us so well. Thank you. We are especially thankful to the staff of the church for visiting us at our home, for the student ministry mission team that Neil McGee led to serve our neighborhood, to a mission team led by Chris Ackerman that served our community. Of course, we know that these teams were sent by all of you who are a part of the United Lynn Haven church family. We are grateful beyond words. On the drive home, I remembered the important truth that the church is more than a building. How truthful this has been to my life. Kat and I will always cherish the relationships we have built with you. We can never repay you for your generosity, but we can promise that we will pay it forward by showing the same spirit of generosity as we continue to serve our community here in Orange Beach. Thank you for standing beside us and for being our church family. Fly with Christ, Tyler and Kat. And that, my friends, that right there is how a congregation learns how to live with wealth. It's okay to gain all you can. It's okay to save all you can. Just make sure that you give all you can. And don't just listen to God's word. You must do what it says. And as I've asked you every week, what are you going to do about it? Let's pray. And I would just ask us as we close that we all just consider our own personal financial situation. And I know there's some of you in this room that have financial needs right now. And if you would, just I encourage you, thank God that that situation is not forever, that it's temporary, but that you still have God and God has you, and He is always enough. And then for any of us that have been entrusted with some measure of wealth, let's also thank God for it, but also let's ask God, what do you want us to do with it, Lord? How do you want us to use it for your purposes and to help others? And God, we do thank you for the riches of your grace. We thank you most especially for Christ Jesus. What a precious treasure he is. We thank you for the riches of your kingdom, both present and future, that will stand the test of time, that will last forever. And whether we have a lot or whether we have nothing, we have you. And that's enough, Lord. But God, we also confess that we understand that we have been blessed beyond measure materially, most of us. And Lord, we just thank you for that. Help us not to hoard it, not to use it for our own selfish purposes and ambition, but help us to use it for your glory and to benefit your people. And God, as the pastor of this church, I just thank you for the ways that I see folks living out the gospel, being real Christians, giving and giving and giving and giving. And Lord, we just pray that through that, attention wouldn't come to us, but instead, honor and glory would come to your name, both now and forever. Amen.